Life is a workout, and Smoothie King is here to help you power through. Whether you're crushing morning miles or sprinting through back-to-back meetings, give your body the energy, protein, and power it needs to help you conquer your goals. Only at Smoothie King.
So yeah, they have been lecturing us about our need to pay for Ukraine's defense while simultaneously spending more on Russian energy than they do on Ukraine's defense. And now they're...
Hence the friends, not such great friends.
Well, not only not such great friends, but suicidal policies of the Biden administration shutting down energy production here so that the only people that do it are, I don't know, Iran, other OPEC countries, and Russia. And it's like, okay.
Welcome to Rivera and Reeves, the podcast where we break through the bias, report the news, and occasionally trip over our soapboxes while ranting about the headlines.
Every week, we tackle the biggest stories with sharp analysis, unfiltered honesty, and just enough sarcasm to keep it fun.
So pull up a chair, grab your coffee, and join us as we wade through the spin because the media is trash and we have zero patience for their nonsense. Hey, friends, and welcome back to another episode of Rivera and Reeves. I'm Sadie, and I am here with my friend Amanda because Rachel has sickness in her house. Hello, Amanda.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
We're so grateful that you're able to join us. Rachel messaged yesterday, both of us on the back channel, and she has some kids that have brought in illness into her home. And she asked for Amanda to join us, and she's going to give us, if you guys have been here for a minute, Amanda Peterson, friend of the podcast, has been here several times where we discuss foreign policy issues and kind of just get a lay of the land of what the administration is doing in regards to foreign policy. So that is going to be our focus today, specifically because Trump has, I think he's still in Scotland, right?
Yes, he's still there.
Okay. So he's been in Scotland doing a business work trip vacation situation. He is golfing while doing massive trade deals. And the one that dominated over the weekend was the trade deal with the EU. And what is her name? Ursula von...
Ursula.
Von der Leyen?
Yeah. Yes, yes.
Yes, we're going to go with that one. But yeah, we're going to talk about the trade deals, the media's narrative with the trade deals. We also have plenty to discuss with Ukraine and Russia, Israel, Gaza. Apparently, there's even something with Thailand and Cambodia, if we have time for that. Well, I don't know. There's a lot going on because why not? So first, let's get started with what the media has reluctantly described, I've noticed this, as Trump's most significant deal ever. And that is the trade deal that he announced with the EU. Not to mention that he also has trade deals with Japan, Indonesia, and the Philippines that he announced. He's going across the world, making deals, slashing tariffs for us, pulling in massive investment. And it's not just economic wins. They're reshaping global alliances, just completely. I mean, honestly, it's like U.S. dominance is cool again. And we're even seeing signs here in the U.S. of reshoring of manufacturing. There were reports that in the first half of the year so far, or this first quarter, a lot of companies were increasing their purchasing in, for manufacturing equipment and that those sort of things too, because the plan is, that looks like a sign of possibly reshoring. So I want to know specifically in regards to this, we're going to start off with this trade. How do you see this EU trade deal and how it's shifting global politics, U.S. leverage, and also I have a clip of Ursula because I'm also fascinated of like the complete change of tune that seems to be coming out from these European countries where they're, I don't know if they like him or if they're kissing up to him, but regardless, it's a better situation.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that first of all, we have to frame where we were going into Liberation Day and the immediate aftermath, which is the left in this country and a lot of geopolitical analysts were saying people were just going to completely abandon the United States because it was so offensive that we would dare put tariffs on them and call them out for their tariffs and non-tariff barriers. And a little over 90 days later, Trump did not achieve 90 deals in 90 days, but he did the two, almost three most important deals. He's got some sort of a framework with China, and they came to us. A deal that never could have happened under any other president with Japan, and never could have happened with any other president other than Trump with the European Union. I mean, the European Union, the framework of that deal, they don't have another option. I mean, there was a lot of talk about, oh, they might pick China over us. China has worse trade restrictions. China is, like, more manipulative than us. I mean,
well, and not only, I mean, I would think that wouldn't be necessarily to the EU's interest because of how tight they're getting with Russia.
That too. And that's another thing. I mean, Europe needs us with the war on Ukraine. They don't have the manufacturing capability just with weapons yet. The United States, we don't, our manufacturing capability for weapons is not near what it needs to be. But it's light years ahead of Europe. It's light years ahead of anywhere else in Asia. They need us. And Trump did something no other president has ever done, which he linked trade deficits and trade-related stuff to weapons and to, I mean, normally people would, presidents would keep that separate. And he said no. And that was a big gamble to take. And he kind of gambled with our economy and with our legitimacy. And he won. And I don't know why people still doubt him, because this is incredible.
Yeah. I mean, it's been very interesting because you'll see in the media where they've even reluctantly had to admit that this is a win for Trump and that this is the most significant trade deal so far. I also found the optics of this entire thing fascinating because... Yeah. Here is a U.S. president who happens to own some very lavish vacation spots. And so he has a golf course in Scotland, and he brings these. So far, we've had Ursula come and visit him at his Trump Scotland resort, which I forget the name of it.
Yeah.
To visit him in their own territory, sit there. And I want you guys to hear Ursula talk about Trump and negotiating with Trump.
Indeed, it is today about trade between the European Union and the United States. We're together the two largest economies worldwide.
Right.
If you look at the trade volume, it's the biggest trade volume globally with $1.7 trillion among us. And if you look at our markets, it's a huge market, 800 million people, if you take the United States and the European Union. So I'm very much looking forward to the discussions we will have now. Our staff have done some of the heavy lifting, but now it's on us.
Yeah.
And you're known as a tough negotiator and deal maker.
But
what is in front? And fair. And what is in front of
us?
That's
less important.
If we are successful, I think it would be the biggest deal each of us has ever struck. Sure. So I'm very much looking forward.
Ever struck by anybody. That's true.
Not just ever struck by anybody.
Just even his mannerisms and that. I'm just like, he's so funny. But I mean, I
don't know. She's sitting, to me, she's sitting there with her legs together, her hands. It's very like proper, very docile, you know. Mm-hmm. Praising him. We've now seen on several occasions where especially European leaders have met with Trump, and they're like, in the past, especially like Angela Merkel, I think about the way their dynamic was during Trump's first administration, and she was just putting up with him, but it was clear that she couldn't stand him. And this time around, it's very different. And there's been a lot made about this trade deal. Like, why is this trade deal in particular such a big deal? Like, what is it? I've heard one criticism, which I thought was really funny, is that there's a few newscasters or a few people in the mainstream media who have commented on how this is a very one-sided deal, and people trying to make the argument that because it's one-sided, that it could negatively affect our image on the world stage as us taking advantage of these countries, of specifically the EU, because what a lot of people have to understand that the EU, it's 27 countries that are opening up for trade. Like, is this a one-sided deal? How significant is this deal? What are we getting in the deal?
Well, it's one-sided for sure. But I think when people are saying that Trump is this could be a bad sign for us, or, you know, bad for legitimacy. It's not bad for legitimacy. If anything, it's just bringing back realpolitik, which is that you can do a one-sided deal when you're the side with leverage. What do the Europeans have over us besides lecturing us? Nothing.
Yeah.
They don't have, like, they need our market. They need us. They're making much larger than 15% profits on the American market because they wouldn't agree to a 15% tariff if they weren't. What are they making? Probably nobody knows. I heard Victor Davis Hanson point that out. Same with the Japanese. Same with, you know, our partners in Asia. Another thing she points out, and this is, these are the two largest economies, like the EU and America. But it's shifting away from that. I mean, right now, I think NATO countries is somewhere around 30% of global GDP. I saw another figure that the America and the European Union right now is 44% of global GDP. Asia is 36% of global GDP, estimated to be like 50% by 2035 or 2040. I mean, we are really shifting away in a big way from understanding the United States and Europe as being the center for global like dominance in the next 10, 15 years. And I don't know, I just feel like Europe is kind of stuck in the past of like, I've even seen a lot of like commentary about, you know, it's always been us together. And it's like, no, I mean, I'm sorry, if you don't have anything to hold over us, it's not us together. I mean,
it's been a very one-sided friendship.
Right. Right. I mean, they've outsourced their defensive needs to us. They can't get that back soon enough. If anything, with this deal, we're holding them accountable because they're building something like $600 billion worth of military equipment from us, which is going to enable us to subsidize our increased defense costs from the big, beautiful bill. Also, just the tariff revenue is going to allow us to basically offset the cost of the deficit that was going to run. I mean, I think this is supposed to bring in something like $2.4 trillion worth of tariff revenue. And this is mostly across industries where I guess I can't believe I'm saying this because I can't believe it's true. But everything I'm seeing reported is like basically with the way numbers shake out, these tariffs are going to affect goods that they can't raise prices too much because whatever the industry.
Like the market can't sustain, like the market won't accept it.
Right.
Yeah.
And so that's where it goes back to, what profit margin have they been making on us?
Yeah.
And what other president would have done anything?
Well, no, any other president would have been too concerned with the, like, I don't know, it's like the person that needs someone's approval, you know, the people pleaser type. That's what, you know, it's, I mean, it's an element of diplomacy. They would see diplomacy as like being kind, making friends, not upsetting anyone, not hurting anybody's feelings, as opposed to the strategy to this administration for the diplomacy is first our interest, America's interest first. And also that it's, we have a balance within the relationship, that it's not so one-sided. And sometimes that takes upsetting people a little bit. But you brought up one thing. There is in this bill, in this trade deal, there was a promise. First of all, it's the 15% tariff that we will now put on European goods. And we have no increased tariff for us to trade with Europe. So we can send goods over there with no added tariff. It also opens, I think it opens up restrictions on agriculture. I think also automobiles, which I think is really funny because I've seen a few people like say, Europeans don't want our cars. And I'm like, I don't know, because every time I see a European come here to the United States, they seem to love them a little bit. They may not want a F-250 to be roaming around the narrow streets of Europe, obviously, but to just say that they don't want our cars, I think is an oversimplification. But
they haven't been able to get our cars
because
they've been so heavily restricted. I mean, it's kind of funny when you go to Germany. I remember my teacher saying this, and then I studied abroad in Germany. And like, when you go to Germany, it's like BMW, Mercedes driving past you. And then people like will swivel their head at a Dodge Ram truck or something because it's not as common over there. That's like a cool thing over there. You wouldn't expect that, but I don't know. I mean, Trump, the two industries he really always stands up for, if you notice, is like farmers and the automobile industry. And I mean, that's the same with Japan. For some reason, they're going to start taking in our rice.
Wow.
I'm surprised about that.
They
might start taking in some of our rice. A lot of like the barriers being opened up is in both Asia and in the European Union deal is American agricultural stuff and cars.
The reports that I'm seeing, if I'm understanding this correctly, is first of all, the U.S. right now for the first time is showing a surplus because of the income that's coming in from trade, which is then going to help deal with the deficit, which, okay, yay, that is absolutely excellent. But the other thing is I've noticed there's like a lot of conversation about that these aren't really deals, that these aren't really trade deals. Specifically, both you and I, we've mentioned and we watch Two Way and Dan Turrentine, which is the Democrat on the panel. Every time one of these trade deals pops up, he's very quick to say, yeah, but, you know, it's not really signed, or they're debating that it, like this other country's not publicly speaking about it or is debating the issue. And specifically, for example, to use the EU trade deal as an example, one of the things that he shared yesterday was an article from Politico. And the Politico article, the headline says, EU admits it can't guarantee $600 billion promise to Trump. Because within that trade deal, he announced that there was going to be a $600 billion investment into U.S. industries. And so this one's pointing out, actually, you can't guarantee it.
I think that was specific to the defense.
Read the article, okay? Yeah. And I just think it's very manipulative. So just be aware, of course, big surprise from the media. But specifically what they're pointing out in this article is that $600 billion comes from private industry. And so the EU can't force the private industry across 27 countries to invest in the United States. They can incentivize them, they can encourage them, but they can't force them. And so the EU, like the governmental body of the EU, can't make a guarantee. But like the United States wouldn't be able to make a guarantee either, because the United States can't force private industry where to invest. You can only do the same thing. You can encourage them. But buried in the article, it also says, however, the first official said that the $600 billion figure was, quote, based on detailed discussions with different business associations and companies in order to see what their investment intentions are. So they didn't make this number up out of nowhere. So do we actually have trade deals? What is going on? Because he is going out there and announcing. He's announced a deal with Japan. He's announced a deal, I think, with India, too. Didn't he announce one with India?
Not India yet.
Okay.
So last week was Japan, Indonesia, the Philippines. The week before that, he also announced one with Vietnam. And then also last week, European Union. And what's important about all of those Asian countries specifically as well is basically we're worried that China could use those countries as go-betweens to get around our much larger tariffs with them. And so that's really the thing there, is that we're closing loopholes and subsidizing defense arrangements that we have with mainly the Philippines, because we have bases there.
So, but these announcements, they're just like, this is the framework of what we've agreed to before they actually, you know, they could change. It's a fair criticism to be like, you know, this isn't guaranteed, nothing is writing. Or also at the same time, you can argue, why would you go out in public and say that you're going to agree to this and then backtrack on it? Like,
right. Yeah. I mean, to that criticism, okay, I guess we can wait and see. But I mean, it's even the thought of the frame. Okay. He's coming out with this big announcement that Japan hasn't really, I mean, they've a little bit walked back what he announced, but not fully. Ursula's sitting there right there with him. I mean, these deals are, they're as good as
signed. In regard, I'm just curious because I'm not aware, but with Japan, how was it kind of walked back?
So part of their deal is structured that they will invest, because they're not going to open their economy as much to American goods and stuff. That's just how they are. They're very protectionist. They always have been. So they're not going to change that. So Howard Lutnick put something in there that they're going to do an investment in American industry to the tune of like $550 billion or something like that. And then I think some report came out, but I can't remember which one, saying that, oh no, just kidding, some of that's going to be loans. Okay, so we don't know the details, but there's money coming in from Japan to the United States. Another key point that we didn't bring up about the European deal too, they're going to spend on American energy.
Oh yeah, so, which is huge because they've been real dependent on Russia.
So yeah, they have been lecturing us about our need to pay for Ukraine's defense while simultaneously spending more on Russian energy than they do on Ukraine's defense. And now they're...
Hence the friends, not such great friends.
Well, not only not such great friends, but suicidal policies of the Biden administration shutting down energy production here so that the only people that do it are, I don't know, Iran, other OPEC countries, and Russia. And it's like, okay. I mean, I don't understand that, but I don't know. It's smart that we're retooling it this way.
Well, I think it would be, it's smart. It just, you know, is my medial understanding of it. Not only does it increase revenue from the United States, but then it separates, it takes revenue away from Russia. And specifically, when you're trying to deal with a conflict between Russia and Ukraine, any kind of resources that you can take away from Russia would, you would assume, would only be helpful to stopping the conflict between Russia and Ukraine. Because
right. Well, the only reason that Russia has been able to maintain its war effort this long is because of its energy sales. When Biden threatened Putin not to invade Ukraine, instead of threatening him with force, he brought to him a sanctions package that excluded energy, basically, because he knew that it would be suicidal to, like, Germany, our probably most important or definitely most important ally in Europe. And so he basically outlined how Putin could fund the war. 3 years in, the only reason Putin can fund the war still is by selling energy mainly to the Chinese, but also to Europe. This is just one other way that he can get around it. I mean, we're doing the steps necessary, in my opinion, to cripple Putin more, to try and force him to make a deal. I still don't know if he will. That conflict might just go on forever, but...
Yeah. Speaking of that, I mean, we've talked about the trade deals, the revenue it's bringing in. Also, the fact that, you know, that the prices haven't increased. Well, like when this entire tariff discussion first happened on Liberation Day, which I was very skeptical of and a little critical of, especially the launching of it. I was like, this is ridiculous. You know, this administration has made quite a few missteps when it comes to PR and launching things, but the expectation was that the tariffs were going to destroy our economy. We're going to see immediate inflation. The cost is going to go down to the consumer. And we actually have so far seen the opposite of that, which is good. I mean, we do have, there is, did you see, this is totally not in my notes, but did you see the post that went viral? Was it last week or over the weekend where the Democrats shared a chart of inflation? So if you guys missed it and you weren't online, the Democrat account, as in the DNC, so it's an official X account. They shared this graph and the headline of the graph was inflation reaches all-time high. And it was because inflation went up, what, like a percentage of a point or something? Like it had barely gone up. It was minimal, but it had gone up a little bit. And their big talking point is that Trump said that he was going to bring inflation down day one, which honestly, anybody who believed that is, you don't understand anything. But the chart itself showed the insane amount of inflation that was seen that happened during the Biden administration. And if anything, it's just showing that inflation has stabilized since Trump has come in. It was so bad. I don't know, whatever that intern, I'm thinking maybe got fired. Because they got completely burned and it was deleted. It was taken down. I just thought, side note, that was really quite amusing.
Thank God 4 years later, finally, they admit that there was inflation under Biden. I mean, it took Trump being in office for them to try and blame him. But I'll even see Democrats now where they'll say, like, well, we've just had to deal with 10 years of Trump because he was running for those 4 years. It's like, I'm sorry, guys. Like,
Wait, that has anything to do with inflation?
Right, right. No, but they're saying, like, we've just been, like, under this cloud of Trump for 10 years. I'm like, I don't know. Biden was in there. He pretended. Jill made him think that he was running
President things.
I don't know if he was. But, I mean, you can't blame Trump for everything. I don't know. Enough Americans wanted him back. It was that bad. So, I don't know.
And I only meant just to wrap, because in the 6 months that we've seen, at least, like, this is foreign policy, but also it's had a significant effect to us domestically. And it's been really interesting to see, especially with this EU trade deal, where the media is kind of having to admit things aren't as bad as we said they were going to be. Because I remember the headlines as soon as all of this started, the tariffs, the renegotiation of trade deals, the full expectation was that it was going to be completely unsustainable and that the added expense is going to be put and it's only going to benefit, you know, the typical talking points. And so far, everything has stabilized. So much so, I mean, even I saw a clip where even Bill Maher was admitting that he was wrong. He was like, I guess it wasn't as bad as everybody's.
I mean, the two takeaways for me with this is that this could be walked back because the next president could choose not to enforce, or the Europeans and Japanese could decide towards the end of Trump's term, there's nothing he can do to stop us and we're not going to invest or something like that. But I think overall, his strategy worked. I'm surprised it worked. I didn't think that this would happen or work, but it has. I mean, they don't have any leverage on us that they could prevent us from doing this. They're not going to China. Russia's aggression, China's worse policies can't, like, they're worse. We've all got to stick together.
People don't want to do business with them because of how difficult it is to do business with them, which I've seen. I listen to the All In podcast, which is a lot of, you know, business tech guy, you know, is typically what they'll discuss there. And that's one of the things that they have brought up is that, you know, we have to do business in China, but we prefer not to do business in China because it's such a pain to do business with them.
And it didn't used to be. They used to try and incentivize American industry and say, hey, if you come build stuff here, we will make it extremely profitable for you. And they stopped doing that. But the one last thing I'll say on this is that the media narrative since Liberation Day has been basically going back to Econ 101, is tariff good or tariff bad?
Yeah.
And Trump has kind of retooled the way that we should think about trade deals and tariffs. I mean, just even bringing in defensive agreements or purchasing American energy into those agreements that's never been done before, and it's interesting, and I wonder if it will remain that we think about things this way. We're not in the mindset of, are tariffs okay or not anymore? We're in the mindset of, do deals benefit America or not?
Yeah.
Life is a workout, and Smoothie King is here to help you power through. Whether you're crushing morning miles or sprinting through back-to-back meetings, give your body the energy, protein, and power it needs to help you conquer your goals. Only at Smoothie King.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Well, and I think the issue with the tariffs, too, is like, if you were to do tariffs alone and be completely dependent on that as being your primary source of income without bringing in other deals, incentivizing business to come into the United States, which then reshores not only U.S. industry, but it also, I mean, it creates jobs. It makes people feel more secure for the future. And then, you know, in addition to regulation cuts and you know, they keep talking about how people are going to lose their Medicare, which is not correct. My point is that you have multiple legs. And Scott Bessa has talked about this, is that, you know, this is like a three-leg project where you're trying to balance out multiple things. And especially when there was a lot of criticism about the Big Beautiful Bill and how it was going to increase the deficit. But that alleged increase in the deficit didn't take into account everything else that the administration is doing, which what this administration is attempting to do, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that instead of the traditional way of just like doing austerity cuts, they're taking a much more business-focused approach, which is to grow our way out of the deficit. Mm-hmm. And that's another way of how this administration is approaching not only the economy, but our foreign, because that's part of how our foreign policy is affecting, because the foreign policy this time is much more economic focused as opposed to being like humanitarian, diplomat, spreading democracy across the land focused. And so it's just, I think people just feel a little destabilized by it, especially anyone who's a talking head.
Right. Well, because that, I mean, this was one of the things that the Democrats ran on being so much better than Trump with is foreign policy. You just need a steady hand. And we don't need, the United States does not need to be the most steady hand in the world in order to be legitimate or seen as a superpower. We need to be better than the alternatives of Russia and China. And we're light years better. Light years better.
Especially, I think back of, remember when Obama did his European apology tour, basically, which completely, I would say, is one of the things. And obviously, there were things before, even during the Bush administration, that shifted things. But I feel like that was the big exclamation point at the end of that diplomacy project, was him doing this apology tour to the European countries and being like, yeah, we're bad Americans. We're sorry about that. And it was just so,
bothers me. But like, this is the thing that bothers me. Every president has done things that so-called delegitimize us. But I don't know. I mean, with the Iraq war, having France come out and saying, hey, we don't think you're going to find what you think you're going to find and you shouldn't do this. And then they were proven right.
They were correct.
That didn't make us look great. But did that make them stop depending on us for defensive needs? No, obviously not. If you just look at Russia, Ukraine. I mean, Obama doing that with like drawing the Russian reset button, drawing the red line, allowing Assad to cross it. Did that make America less legitimate? No, it didn't. I mean, not at all. Right. But Trump is doing all these things to make us illegitimate, and they're only relying on us more. And I don't even think that we can fully chalk that up to Trump. I just think that the writing is on the wall. The next 30 years are going to be much more geopolitically unstable than the previous 30 years. We're going to see more war and more conflict. They know who they need in their corner for that. They're not going to be able to run a massive trade surplus or trade deficit with us, in addition to, again, needing us through that. And I think that Trump fits the moment with that.
So speaking of conflict specifically when it comes to the EU, and we also touched on this because the trade deal is significant because they're switching their energy purchases over to the United States and away from Russia. Let's talk about Ukraine for a moment, because Trump has sent more Patriots requested over to Ukraine, greenlit long-range strikes deep into Russia. Like, this is what I'm understanding. And publicly has given Putin a deadline to end the war. Now, this is after this administration first came in and appeared to be kind of soft with Putin. We're friends. And I don't think he was necessarily being soft. He was just trying to butter him up, and because he does this strategy of like publicly giving accolades and being nice in order to butter you up because he needs something from you. So it's like attracting the flies with honey. But he seems to be, I don't know if he's gotten frustrated, he's like done, but his tune appears to be changing with Russia, and he's becoming a little bit more hawkish with them. I don't know if that's a fair assessment, but he just seems much more open, supplying more to Ukraine, being more supportive of Ukraine in their fight against Russia. And oddly enough, I haven't seen a ton of criticism from his base about that compared to what we would have seen during the Biden administration. So has his tune changed? And if so, why do you think that's happening?
I think his tune has definitely changed. I've also noticed that there's not as much criticism from MAGA over this. I don't know if that's because they're preoccupied with Epstein and this just really isn't in the news. Honestly, that's probably it. But I also think that it kind of goes to show that there's not this rabid pro-Russia sentiment, or MAGA has been characterized and like super anti-Ukraine focus. I think that MAGA has rightly pointed out that it seemed like the focus a lot of the time under the Biden administration was in providing a bunch of materials to Ukraine and then not really focusing on things at home. Trump, there hasn't been that. I mean, there haven't been these massive, I don't know, was that a train derailment in Ohio? Remember when Trump?
Yeah, there was. Are you talking about East Palestine?
Yes.
Are you talking about like a while ago? Yeah. And then, I mean, we've had a few things that have happened here domestically. We had East Palestine. We had the hurricane. A lot of times, like, where is our administration? What are they doing here for the United States? Why they're sending money and arms and resources over to Ukraine and Israel also.
Right.
But, yeah.
But to me, like, MAGA was more frustrated by that happening at home, feeling there like there was an action in the same week. Almost every time there was like a massive aid supplemental sent to an ally. You can't, you know, and in this deal, I don't know. Trump is like saying he's going to send more Patriots than requested, but I think it's Germany and Poland are paying for the Patriot systems. Those are missile interception systems. I think we depleted a lot of our stockpile of interceptors in the Israel-Iran war. So we need to start making more of those.
Yeah, reshoring that for sure.
Yeah, we need to start. Well, yeah, we just need to like dramatically increase our output because we've always produced those here. But then greenlighting strikes on Moscow. I mean, here's the thing. Like, what's interesting to me about that is that a lot of like the more prominent realists in Trump's cabinet, like an Elbridge Colby, for instance, who's like the Secretary of Defense for Strategy or something, Undersecretary for Defensive Strategy, they would be very against something like that because they think that that could widen the war and make Russia attack the United States. And they don't want to broaden this to the point where Russia might threaten us and get us involved or threaten a NATO country. And I understand that. But at the same time, Putin is not going to end the war if he does not feel under pressure. And when Trump said he doesn't want forever wars and long wars, that either means that he can surrender Ukraine, basically, which if Putin rolls into Kyiv, that's going to be like the Afghanistan withdrawal 2.0. That would be a horrific legacy for Trump. Or he can escalate to de-escalate, which that's probably the better option, but it's not a perfect one. And again, I guess the Epstein stuff is just thank you, I guess, Pam Bondi for screwing that up so bad because nobody cares about Russia and Ukraine.
I mean, some people say that is a distraction more than anything to distract what he's doing over here with Ukraine. I guess it's different because a lot of people get upset. I would say the criticisms are Rachel, like my co-host, which is fair. It's about money. It's about us spending money over there and adding to the deficit. And those being her primary concerns of like, why do we have to keep sending money over there? However, also at the same time, especially when you're looking at this through the lens of international trade and these trade deals, we don't want Russia to go through Ukraine and decide to move into the EU because now we're benefiting more from our relationship with the EU. Which also would be something that I would guess Russia would take more into consideration now, which might be another type of deterrent. I'm not 100% sure. This is just me using my logic here. But a lot of people, first of all, it gives a talking point. You can say that it gives a talking point to the Democrats that, well, he said he was going to end the war on day one and he hasn't. And if anything, he's escalating it. But it's very different from the previous administration because the Biden administration would just keep sending them arms and money, but there was no negotiation or no conversation. In fact, I don't think Biden spoke to Putin or to the Russians his entire presidency, if I'm, am I mistaken about that?
Not publicly. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure there were back channels, but no, not publicly. And that was like kind of one of the big criticisms is like throughout the entire Cold War, we always had back channels going back and forth between us and the Soviets to make sure that we weren't going to cross any red lines that could have erupted the Cold War and made it a hot one. And for many reasons, namely the fact that Biden was not probably mentally all there and couldn't be trusted on a phone call with Putin. Honestly, he didn't speak to him. But the problem with like the Ukraine talking point from the Democrats always for me is that if you act like the Biden administration was pro-Ukraine, I don't care how many speeches he gave, and he didn't give that many. He never sold that war to the American people.
No.
He would slow drip weapons to them and give them enough to keep Putin out like from taking more territory.
But not enough for Ukraine to win.
Right. And so that created this over 2 year now conflict that the American people are sick of. We're sick of paying for. We wanted to be focused at home. Trump has tried the route with like trying to negotiate with Putin. It hasn't worked. Now he's got the Europeans paying for American systems. My big question on that is, are we producing enough to replenish our own stockpiles? But also there is something to be said about if Ukraine can really hold off Russia and wear them down as they have been, we probably don't need as much in our stockpiles for a potential conflict with them. So there's that too. But with Europe also reinvesting more in their defense and stuff, I don't know. I mean, we'll have to see escalate to de-escalate. I don't see this. Putin can't handle a NATO conflict right now, even though he's stacking troops on the border of Finland. He can't handle a conflict with all of us. So
how much support is he getting from like China and North Korea? Like, is it enough to continue this? Do you understand what I'm saying? Like,
yeah.
I'm just curious because, you know, you can even argue that Russia's war with Ukraine is a China's proxy war with the United States.
And it kind of is. Yeah. And I mean, a headline actually just came out about that a couple weeks ago, or I remember reading an article that a Chinese foreign minister basically told a European Union official, like, yeah, we can't let Russia stop because if they stop, then America could focus on us in the Pacific. And as much as I would like this and a lot of people would like this, I don't think we're ever going to focus on the Pacific anytime soon. But there is that consideration with this as well.
Would a trade deal, because there's still talks about like the big trade deal, like the big whale is China. Mm-hmm. Would a trade deal with China have an effect of, you know, their support with Russia in this conflict? Do you think it would do anything?
No, I mean, no.
Long silence.
They're going to be together. There's nothing we can do. They're going to be reliant on one another for now. I don't think there's going to be a Sino-Russo split again anytime soon. If anything,
well, I I'm thinking through it. And I don't know if I'm wrong, but I think it really puts us in a difficult position because right now we have created over time such a dependence on China, you know, when it comes to especially manufacturing, access to batteries, you know, all these sort of things, which batteries are a big deal. I almost wonder sometimes if we're kind of like in a similar situation as the Europeans with the energy that they were purchasing from China. So you're trying to bring an end to this conflict between Ukraine and Russia, but then we're also partnering and paying into, frankly, the economy of China, which is supplying Russia. So I'm just curious, like, how do you see this? It just seems like a crazy, vicious circle. And like, how can you even get this to stop the conflict specifically between Ukraine and Russia? Like, on a scale from 1 to 10, what is the likelihood that we can see an end to this conflict before the end of the Trump administration?
I don't see how it ends right now, but I also didn't think that the trade deals would work out in the way that they did. The Iran strikes were incredibly successful. To me, if anything, that alone is going to deter Russia and China from further action under the Trump administration because they realized that our planes could fly over enemy countries and they didn't even know, just completely go through their air defense systems. Our allies didn't even know what we were doing. That's how high tech our stuff is. Nobody, so they can't compete in that realm. So they're going to keep things in a gray zone. So I don't know. I mean, we'll have to see. I'm not super bullish on the war ending anytime soon, but I also kind of know not to bet against Trump on these things. So we'll have to see.
Well, and then speaking of other conflicts, what in the world is going on right now with, because Gaza and Israel have been in the headlines again. Specifically, there, this last week, I've only been following it on the edges, but there appears to be a type of humanitarian crisis. Then, I mean, I am not 100% sure whether to call it blatantly propaganda, because I don't know how honest or dishonest it's been. I think, I mean, I'm leaning more towards the dishonest. But Gaza has been in the headlines, specifically because there are reports of increased, you know, starvation, that allegedly Israel is keeping aid out of the area, that they're firing on civilians trying to get access to aid. And this is everything that we're hearing coming out onto the mainstream media headlines, which is really challenging because, as far as I understand, we don't really have a whole bunch of people on the ground in Gaza specifically. And most of the information that does come out of Gaza is coming out from their health ministry, which is Hamas.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
now that's where I was a few months ago. Has there been an update since? Are there people there? Like, what is going on in Gaza and with Israel?
No, I think you're largely right. I mean, I think the problem right now is that Hamas will not accept a deal to end this war.
They just met somewhere, didn't they? Then wasn't there just a meeting?
Left talks in Doha. So Steve Witkoff left talks in Doha last week, and this is what I will give him credit for. And a lot of people don't like him in the pro-Israel space. They think he's too soft on Qatar, too soft on Hamas, all these things. I will give him credit because under the Biden administration, when we would walk away from the table because Hamas was being unreasonable, Hamas is basically non-existent at this point. And this is kind of like the frustration with the global community in Israel and Qatar and Hamas. They're basically non-existent. There's a couple political leaders who don't live in Gaza who are negotiating on their behalf, but Hamas does not have the capability to really attack Israel. They probably still have stockpiles of rockets and things that have been kept underneath in the tunnels. But Israel obviously has air dominance over Gaza. They could take out rocket launch pads if they needed to, if they began launching them again. But basically, Israel for 2 years has not overseen the disbursement of aid because they're worried that aid distribution points will become ambush sites. So anywhere Hamas sees an IDF,
use them to attack the IDF.
Right. So they don't want that to happen. Yeah, exactly. And can we imagine that they would do something like that? So we're kind of at the stalemate because there's 50 hostages left in Gaza right now. It's believed around 20 are alive. Israel wants to get them back. They also want Hamas to surrender and leave the Gaza Strip and give every hostage back. Hamas is not going to do that because they understand that they will die as soon as they give hostages back. And so they're unfortunately just doing the most disgusting thing ever, which is holding civilians hostage in order to keep them as leverage. And we just haven't been able to break through on this. So right now what's happening is they created this new aid distribution system, which is partially employs American private military contractors, called the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, which they say is dispersing millions of meals. There's still mass hunger in Gaza, and that can't be denied. And it's true that up to this point throughout the war, Hamas always lies about this, and they always say that it's worse than the situation is on the ground. But 2 years in, when Hamas is defeated and there is still this humanitarian crisis going on, which Israeli media in Hebrew has covered. And when they've covered it, the IDF and the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation has made changes to their policy. That is not a country committing a genocide does not have independent media, like independently
calling
looking
out
at
what they're doing and then
and then them changing things. This is not a genocide, but there is hunger in Gaza. And I think that the global community is just kind of like, enough. Like, they're not going to surrender. They're not going to give back the hostages. You've got to figure out another system. We also have to remember that the Israelis keep sending in IDF soldiers who keep getting ambushed. They keep losing soldiers in this fight. It's unclear to me what continued military action will do. I don't think that it will ever force Hamas to surrender. Hezbollah is utterly defeated. They never surrendered. Iran is utterly defeated. They never surrendered. The Houthis can fire one missile every once in a while. So this is just a difficult situation. And in my opinion, Israel's got to kind of retool their strategy. Jonathan Shanzer from Commentary he's from Foundation for Defense of Democracies, but he wrote something in Commentary Magazine kind of giving a third alternative. Israel doesn't have to surrender. Hamas isn't going to surrender. But if we're not going to have an all-out achievement in this war or victory, what Israel could do is they could pause the fighting right now. They could flood the zone with humanitarian aid, which is what they should do. One of the things that makes us proud to support Israel, or me proud to support Israel, is that they do way more than any. I mean, they give way more notice and things on like strike locations and stuff than the U.S. military ever would. They give more aid than the United States ever would in on any of these circumstances. So they have a moral and ethical obligation to continue being that power. And right now, they've not been presented as one doing that. But also, just don't let any rebuilding materials in the Gaza Strip until Hamas fully surrenders. And they can still do targeted strikes on rocket site locations. They could do a raid to rescue hostages, although Hamas has kind of made it clear that they will kill the hostages if that happens. But it's probably time to stop the fighting as it has been going on.
That's the thing that I've been curious about, that I've been watching, especially this past week. You know, there's been some viral images of a starving child, which, you know, the information that's come out is actually that child has a degenerative disease, which contributes to the condition that they're in. And that, like, for example, their sibling was cropped out of the image, and the sibling
is fine. Yeah,
it looks fine. You know, I mean, probably hungry, but looks fine in comparison, especially to this emaciated child. Full acknowledgement that there is a humanitarian crisis in Gaza, that they need food, that there's a crisis in supplies. And, you know, the challenge here is that it seems that in regards to narrative, Israel is losing the narrative war. It almost reminds me of, I actually mentioned this to Rachel, like it kind of reminds me of the situation that we were in with Ukraine a while back, where obviously the extent of their power is completely different, but only in that Zelensky was just completely unwilling to make any changes. And it was like, this is the only way I'm going to end this, or that we're going to be able to accomplish this. He would make absolutely no concessions. He wouldn't change course, which brought a lot of animosity against Ukraine, especially from Americans. And I feel like something similar is happening specifically with Israel, even where traditionally people who would support Israel, I think even Huckabee recently was critical of what Israel is doing. And I think actually that stemmed from there was a Catholic church that was like the only Catholic church in Gaza that was hit.
Okay. The church in Gaza was hit. It was, I guess, shrapnel, or it wasn't the intended target, but it's a bad look, right? There's a church in the West Bank that there was a fire. It was suspected arson. It's a church that there wasn't any wood in it. I don't know the exact details, but there was a fire around an old church site in the West Bank that Huckabee visited. And then on top of that, Huckabee went after the Israelis because evangelical ministries who have been trying to get visas to visit Israel have been denied visas. And as soon as it was elevated and the Israeli government took care of it, that stopped. It was somebody in like lower level ministries who were just not greenlighting the visas as fast as they normally would be. But these were things that were coming after, like one after the other. And it kind of fed into the narrative that people say that Israel doesn't treat Christians well, which I think is complete BS. And I'm Christian, and I've been to Israel, and I was never spat at. And all of our religious sites are there, and you can visit them. And there's a lot of interesting internal political dynamics with Christians in Israel, because some of them, like in Jerusalem, identify as Palestinian. They kind of have a problem. Arab Christians in like more the Galilee, they're fine. They don't have problems, but Christian sites sometimes will be shut down on holidays because they're worried what's going to happen in Jerusalem if there's going to be like terrorist activity or something exploiting the holidays. A lot of the Christians in Israel are Russian.
Oh, really?
Yeah. This is a really interesting thing. When the Soviet Union fell, a lot of people just wanted to escape. the Soviet Union. And so some of them kind of exploited Israel's immigration policy, which is that if you have one Jewish grandparent, kind of like in the Holocaust, you could have been exterminated in Nazi Germany for having one Jewish grandparent. So in their immigration policy right now, if you have one Jewish grandparent, you can immigrate to Israel and they'll pay for your flight and stuff to help you escape persecution. So a lot of Russians who had one Jewish grandparent but were Christian immigrated there. And they live in kind of the north now around Haifa and stuff. And they're not really, they don't feel Israeli. They've never really bought into being Israeli. They've been there for 30 years. But this is why they have an interesting relationship with Russia, Bibi does. And there's a lot of interesting things that go into that. But this is a long way of saying that the longer this war goes for Israel, the more they lose the PR war. And to me, as a staunch supporter of Israel, I don't see a clear path to victory for them right now because I don't think we'll ever surrender. And the longer this goes on, the more the PR war continues that they lose.
Yeah. How much Hamas is there still in Gaza?
I don't know, because I just saw Rebecca Heinrichs from the Hudson Institute put out that they think they've killed 30 to 35% of the fighting forces. Israel's arrested a lot of them, and like they're being held in Israeli jails right now, too. Again, not something that happens in a genocide. It's like, I don't know. I mean, 2 years in, Gaza's a parking lot in many cases, and you've only killed 30 to 35% of the fighting forces. Like, what are we doing here? I don't know. So that's kind of my issue.
So how does, like, how does, because they've walked away from the meeting that they had in, you said in Doha, right, with the Hamas leadership.
Yeah.
Is there anything, like, to be continued? Are there any future plans? Like, what is Trump's responsibility here? He came in saying he was going to end it. I mean, I think that was a bold statement. What political pressure can we use to get our... Because honestly, it has to be really the only pressure, I might be wrong, but the most pressure that we can apply is pressure to Israel.
Well, that's kind of the hard thing with both of these conflicts, right? We can exert the most pressure on the power that we have more power over, which is the side that we're supplying weapons to. Mm-hmm. The thing that I think Trump has done pretty well is he doesn't meddle in Israeli internal politics. The other kind of interesting thing when you look at internal polling done in Israel, like 70% of Israel wants this war to end. They want any deal to bring back the hostages, and they want the war to be over, especially after Iran, especially after, to me, it's the Assad regime falling. I mean, if Syria can no longer be used as a land bridge to resupply Hezbollah, the resistance axis is effectively crumbled. There's no reason to keep this going except to get hostages, which, like I said, I don't think that the fighting in the current state will bring back the hostages. But the majority of the Israelis want this to end too. And so right now it's kind of Bibi's far right that wants the war to continue. And if Trump comes out and puts pressure on the far right or withholds weapons, that actually emboldens the far right. The far right in Israel has wanted to end Israeli dependence on U.S. weapons for a long time because they understand that when we give them weapons, we have control, and they don't want that. And so I think letting Bibi kind of figure out that political situation is kind of the right move. But I hope he figures it out quickly because I don't know how much longer this can continue.
Well, okay, so we're talking a lot about Israel and what they're doing to Gaza, but what about Jordan and Egypt and other Muslim countries in the region? Are they providing any aid to, you know, the Palestinian people or the Gazan people or whatever? Are they helping them out?
They started doing aid drops again. I think Jordan, the UAE, and Egypt all started doing aid drops again. It should also point out, when we're talking about aid and stuff, there's been aid sitting since the end of June, like massive stockpiles that the UN is not distributing. Yeah, and I don't understand what that is. So you have the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation sites, which have been providing aid, but there's been violence because Hamas ambushes the sites, or it's a combination between Hamas ambushing the sites and the IDF, who is guarding Gaza Humanitarian Foundation sites, are not trained for policing. They're trained for combat. So they'll shoot like rubber bullets in the air to kind of quell the situation. That's just not, that's like a combat strategy, not a policing strategy. David Daoud from Foundation for Defensive Democracies talked about this on an episode of Generation Jihad talking about the difference between like occupying and policing versus combat, and how the IDF's not really trained for occupying and policing anymore. They haven't really been since the Second Intifada, so like the early 2000s and stuff. And so there's like kind of that nuance to the situation too. But then you also have these UN distribution sites. And for whatever reason, there was aid to be delivered and they were not delivering it. I don't know.
There's no explanation as to why.
They've not answered for it. And the narrative that a lot of people who are pro-Israel have gone with is that the UN just does Hamas's bidding. I don't know if that's the right way to characterize it. I mean, quite frankly, again, I'm extremely pro-Israel, but it's just, it's kind of unacceptable that 2 years into a war, we haven't figured out, like, kind of the basics.
Yeah.
How are we getting aid to non-Hamas people? And I think that at a certain point, it's not acceptable anymore to blame Hamas. It's not acceptable to blame the UN. We've got to figure this out. And if they can't figure it out, then again, like, they've got to pause and figure out a way that they can win the war, because they can't, we can't keep doing this. Like, you know,
well, I mean, you know, war isn't just kinetic. It's also a war of messaging. And mm-hmm. And then you also have to consider the people that are being affected by the war, you know, the people in Gaza. What is their sentiment going to be once Hamas leaves? Like, are they going to, do you understand what I'm saying? Like, if they're going to view, I don't know what the dynamics are in there, but, you know, my question is, are they going to view Hamas as the reason that they're starving, or are they going to view Israel as the reason that they're starving? And one of them, depending on how it goes, is more problematic for the interests of the United States and Israel, obviously, than it would be for Hamas. So I feel like, you know, it's almost like I think back to the World War II, where the Allies were seen as liberators because they came in and they saved people and they fed them and they got them medical treatment and everything like that. And that's part of where, whatever, like, that's where the narrative of the Allies comes from, of them being saviors or something along those lines. And I'm just thinking about, like, there's also this talking, like, I'm very hesitant about, you know, a lot of times they'll say, well, if you continue, especially we saw this after post 9/11, that you radicalize people when you invade their countries or when you occupy them. And while that's true, sometimes I think they would have been radicalized anyways. Like, it doesn't necessarily have to do with
occupation. Gaza especially, I mean, that is the most anti-American, anti-Israel population on the planet. I think the United States and Israel have like a 4% approval rating there. So we can only go up. You can't really go down from that. To me, it's like the radicalization thing. I think it's radicalizing people here because they didn't know anything about the conflict and they've heard a one-sided telling of the story for the last 2 years. In Gaza, it's different. And honestly, they can't speak out. We can't know exactly what they're thinking because we can't get an accurate polling when they're worried that they're going to be ambushed by Hamas or killed by Hamas for speaking out. I mean, every time Israel's done a ceasefire, the people who have spoken out against Hamas goes and ambushes them. We don't know exactly what they're thinking. All I know right now is that the current plan's not working. So
yeah,
we got to figure something else out. But it's not a genocide. I mean, it's sad.
Well, overall, I'm just going to start to wrap us up because, I mean, there's plenty of things. We still, like, there was, you know, China's always... Yeah, on the edges, messing with the dynamics in the world. You know, Syria was in the news recently because there was some conflict up in Syria, and also that Israel did some strikes on Syria, which seemed, I didn't understand the context of that and seemed to have come out of nowhere, but added to the criticism against Israel. Can you summarize real quick what that was about?
Yeah. So there's an ethno-religious minority in Syria that also has a very big presence in Israel. They're called Druze. It's kind of a secretive ethno-religious minority. They're Arab, but within Israel, they serve in the IDF. They serve in combat units more often. So there's like a higher death ratio of Druze in the IDF and things. There's a lot of Druze who live in Soweida, which is a province of southern Syria that is basically been an autonomous region since the Assad regime fell in December. The new leader of Syria, al-Shara or Jolani, wants all of Syria to be under his government. He feels that that's important for all of Syria to be under his control. I don't disagree with him. I think if Syria's autonomous or balkanized, that'll make it easier for Iran to step back in. But the Druze are scared to give up their weapons to Jalani because people are made up of like former Al-Qaeda people, and jihadists aren't typically great to minorities. So there's been a lot of fighting, and Israel has gone in on behalf of the Druze. Again, because there's such a public sentiment that like they have to protect Druze. The Free Press did some really good reporting on this that came out yesterday. I'd recommend if people want to know more, they check that out. But basically, there's a civil war happening in Syria, like a low-grade civil war going on. The Druze population of Ceuta is conflicted. Some of them want to join the new Syrian regime. Some of them want to remain autonomous and be backed by Israel. So there's just kind of that has thankfully died down. The ceasefire is held there. But the U.S. is coming down on the side of al-Shara in that instance and wanting Israel to stop striking.
And why is that? I'm just curious. Like, what is the logic of... Because, I mean, typically it's always like supporting Israel over above anybody else. And it seems like in this situation, it's reversed. And is it because of their concerns with Iran also, especially considering that we struck Iran, what was it, like a month ago?
Yeah. Part of it might be Iran. I think the Saudis and the Turks are heavily backing al-Shara. And so the Puritan or the purist sense is that like al-Shara's former al-Qaeda, he was on the FBI watch list 5 minutes ago. Why are we trusting him now? Fair.
Yeah. Why I'm curious. Like, why are we?
Yeah. It's fair. However, there's kind of not an alternative. We're not going to invade Syria and reoccupy.
Well, and it's clear this administration is not about regime change. Yeah. So they're not going to come in.
No. Yeah. And so we've kind of got to deal with who we've got to deal with. And right now, that guy happens to be Abu Muhammad al-Jalani, a.k.a. what is his new name? Ahmed al-Shara. It's a messy situation, but I tend to be on the, I totally understand where Israel's coming from, but I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, he's going to be there. We've kind of got to let it happen.
Like, you have to deal with, this is your neighbor. This is what you have to deal with right now.
Well, and the last thing I will say is, as Americans, if we want to stop invading other countries to pursue our political will there, like on behalf of minorities and things like that, we're going to have to deal with headlines like this sometimes, which are that minorities are being killed. And they were killing Alawites in Latakia, which is like on the border, or it's like kind of near Lebanon.
Which is, I mean, obviously really unfortunate and sounds kind of callous. But then also at the same time, you can't have... You know, you can't have it both ways. You can't be meddling, doing regime change, forcing people, trying to encourage or force countries to follow your ways, and then also not be using our resources in foreign wars. Like, you just, you can't have it both ways. You have to pick one. And one, depending on where you stand, one might be more tolerable than the other.
Right. So no, it's an unfortunate situation, for sure.
But... Now, those are the so Israel and Gaza and Ukraine and Russia are the biggest conflicts, of course, that most people know about. But Trump has managed to get some peace deals in other ways. I mean, you see Marco Rubio posts all the time. We're paying attention to, I think there was India and Pakistan. There was it the Congo
and Rwanda?
And Rwanda. Then most recently, there was Cambodia and Thailand, like something bubbled
Armenia,
up.
Armenia, Azerbaijan as well.
There are a few lesser known conflicts going on that the administration is brokering peace deals in and instituting diplomacy. Was that something that the previous administration also did? And we just didn't hear about it because Trump, obviously, he has a drop of a win, anything. And he's going to be like, this is the most amazing thing ever. I'm dominating here. You know, he is dying to get that Nobel Peace Prize. OK, so anytime there is an opportunity, he's going to tout it. So I'm just curious because it's not really my beat. It's not really something that I follow. In previous administrations, were these smaller conflicts dealt with like this administration is doing? And is he just like using them to prop himself up as like the...
I think there's part of that. Well, okay, there's two main things I'll say with this quickly. The first is that one of the big criticisms of Trump by people who are very skeptical of what they would call isolationism is that Trump is going to recede from the world and allow spheres of influence. So China can kind of oversee what's going on in Asia. Russia can have its say in the Caucasus and in Eastern Europe and the Baltics. And then we kind of deal with our hemisphere. That's clearly not true, because Trump would not be dedicating a Truth Social post to Thailand, Cambodia, if he was just receding from the global stage. There are also people who are like really big World War III truthers who are like, it's going to pop off any day. And
yeah,
so
that happened with Iran. That was the full expectation.
But they're also saying it about Thailand, Cambodia, because Cambodia is backed by the Chinese. We are a treaty ally with Thailand. So some people were hypothesizing that was going to become a proxy war between China and the United States. That didn't happen. Also, if Trump was being controlled by the neocons, like Tucker Carlson says, he would have allowed that to go on and sold more weapons to Thailand and lined the pockets of Lockheed Martin executives or whatever.
Good point.
That didn't happen. So to me, it's that Trump negotiating the end to that conflict, India, Pakistan, Armenia, Azerbaijan, and what's going on in Africa. I think it just goes to show that it's a priority for him in this administration to kind of show our leadership and show that America can be the ones in charge. I will say, so I know this because I have a friend who works in this stuff. Tiffany Trump's father-in-law, Mossad Boulos, has been named the special envoy to Africa, but it's not a Senate confirmed position, where he's just going into all these conflicts in Africa one by one and kind of resolving them. So I guess right now he's working on Sudan, but he negotiated the end to Congo, Rwanda. That has been going on since the 90s, since the Rwandan genocide.
I mean, it's a bigger deal than what the media would acknowledge it to be.
We don't talk about these things. We don't talk about Asia, even though it's by far the most important theater. Nobody in American media cares about Asia, and nobody really cares about Africa. And I just think it kind of goes to show that, like, one guy kind of in the Trump orbit was like, I'd like to do this. And Trump just was like, OK, yeah, go ahead. And like how cool it is that American leadership and kind of the Trump celebrity effect makes people just want to say, OK, yeah, we'll negotiate. We'll see what we can do.
It'll definitely be interesting to see if any and all of this holds,
post-Trump,
you know, because he's like his own force. Now, I wasn't kind of encouraged. Like, I feel like even though Marco Rubio is kind of like under the radar, he's doing a good job. He's doing what needs to be done. He was recently interviewed and asked if he had any interest in running for president. And he was pretty specific on saying no, that his intentions were to do his full 4 years as Secretary of State with the Trump administration. And I believed him in this context because he said, the State Department and being Secretary of State is not a political position. Mm-hmm. And he would have to dip out here in like a year if he was actually going to be running for president. And he said, that is not my interest because, you know, I would have to leave as Secretary of State in order to run for office because it's not supposed to be a political position. And his intention is to do the full 4 years. So in that sense, there's at least that element that could be consistent throughout this administration and possibly into the next one, especially if J.D. Vance ends up getting the nomination. Like, do you think J.D. Vance would sideline Rubio? I'm just curious. Like, I'm curious.
I don't know. I mean, I don't think anybody knows what J.D. Vance's politics would be or like foreign policy would be, because he used to be pretty hawkish. Now he's become kind of dovish. To me, the biggest thing about Vance is that he's very close with like the tech people, and the tech people are extremely hawkish on China. And even like Trump's isolationist so-called wing comes from the realist perspective, not of wanting to retreat from the global stage, but wanting to draw down our presence in other areas of the world, draw up our allies in replacement of us. So not just backing out like Obama did and making a deal with our freaking enemy to backfill our position. That was bizarre with Iran. But instead to focus all of our attention on China. And so that's good to know. But then Trump's kind of faltering on China right now. So I don't know. I guess we'll have to see. But China's a hard one, too. I mean, I don't know if you saw, but the Trump administration is not allowing the president of Taiwan to do a stopover in New York City.
I did see that. And I thought that was weird. Like, what's that about?
So that super disappointing, but not out of character for a U.S. administration. When we are trying to get something out of the Chinese, like Trump is probably going to go to China in October when he goes to South Korea for the APEC summit. He's going to want to do a summit with China and he wants them to close on a trade deal. So what we do in the lead up to that is we don't want to provoke China. So we don't have any like conversations with Taiwan or anything like that. They don't like that. The bummer about that is it's in keeping with the status quo. This is not something that no other politician would do. But Trump is breaking the status quo on everything else with trade deals and with, you know,
but
brokering.
But he kind of does status quo for a little bit, especially if down the road he's working on something that is bigger and actually might be a little bit more disruptive. So he's kind of like, I don't know, like keeping his savings in the bank before he has to do a full cash out later. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so that might be part of it, because that's kind of something that he does. You know, people get frustrated with that, especially anyone who opposes Trump. They use that as an opportunity to point out his inconsistencies and that he's a liar or that you can't trust him. But it's also because you're unwilling to look at his strategy as like holistically.
Overall, yeah.
And you're just like focused on, you know, the one thing that upsets you.
Yeah. That's like the one complaint I have with Trump right now is like that little bit of faltering on Taiwan. And he could easily make up for that. I mean, Taiwan and China are like doing competing military drills all summer. I don't know if you've seen this, where like they have their live drills. Yeah, Taiwan just had its like Hong Kong, which is like 2 weeks or 10 days of live action. They're preparing for tanks rolling down the streets of Taipei and seeing what they would do about that. They called up like tons of reserves to practice fighting. That's another thing I think that is so interesting when we talk about like an isolationist push in the United States and we like, oh, we don't want to be involved. We don't want to be involved. We don't have military drills preparing for China to come invade us, that we all just have to go about our daily lives while all of our sons and husbands have to be called up and go into their reserve duty. I mean, it's incredible like what they have to go through to prepare for an invasion of China. And we just don't even care. We don't even know about it. But like, this is all happening. So
I mean, honestly, if anything has shown us over the last few years is that Americans, especially young Americans and Americans in general, like we're just so privileged that we are looking for things to be upset about.
Foreign policy tends to be the thing that we like have a lot of opinions about, but a lot of people don't quite understand. And it's
So I'm going to go ahead. I'm going to start wrapping us up. But if you were to say one major, specifically in regards to foreign policy, one major accomplishment and also one big criticism so far in the 6 months, what would you point to?
I think the biggest accomplishment would be these trade deals, particularly with Japan and with the EU. Hopefully one is coming soon with South Korea and with India.
Which the deadline is supposed to be August, allegedly. August 1st. And Letnik is like, we're not extending anything. So
yeah, we might see a couple more. Or Trump's going to play hardball. I don't know. I mean, I think India might be a little mad after the India-Pakistan conflict that we didn't back them enough. I don't know. We'll have to see. Also, Apple just said that they're going to start producing a bunch of iPhones in India to like get around the tariffs with China. And then if we have a deal framework with China and not with India, that probably won't work out that well. But we'll give an exemption, I'm sure, to Apple. Kind of big criticism I would have, aside from what I just said about not allowing the president of Taiwan to stop over in New York City, Trump is giving China access to NVIDIA chips that we were previously not allowing China to access. And I think that that's really stupid. I just don't know if we have the leverage to stop that. Also, China imports them anyways, because they open up shell companies
and get them that way.
Yeah, in like Singapore or the Caucasus and import them through there that way. So
is it, I heard, I didn't hear that mention and that criticism specifically about NVIDIA chips, but I heard, and I don't know if this is a valid caveat or whatever, but that they're allowing it, but only on older generations, not on their newest developments. Is that correct?
Yeah. I mean, I'm not a chips person, so don't quote me fully. I think it's the H20 NVIDIA chip, which is not the most advanced. But it's more advanced that we were allowing them to have. And I'm not quite clear what we're getting in return. If what we're getting is like keeping them at the deals table, how much more are we going to have to concede to get China to accept a deal, especially when they keep devaluing their currency and increasing manufacture? I mean, there's a lot of stuff going on that is not good with China's economy. I just don't understand, if their economy is faltering because of our tariff situation, why are we giving them NVIDIA chips?
Well, and also it's not like China's the most trustworthy, because people will be like, well, they're not giving them the most advanced. And I'm like, but you're giving them access to stuff that could lead them to more advanced product. And they're notorious for reverse engineering and copyright violations. So my question is, like, why, you know, I agree with you. Like, why would you give it to them in the first place? Because what you're giving them is a leg up to potentially reverse engineer something and then make something more advanced if they use some initiative and not just copy pasting like they typically do.
What do you think, though? What do you think are the good and bad?
I mean, I agree with you. Like, the trade deals is significant, not just because it rebalances our relationships and our trade with these other countries, but it is evidence of how the status quo was just no longer sustainable and that it is okay to try something new and that we're just in a completely different economy. You mentioned before, like, the traditional idea of tariff good, tariff bad, or how tariffs were used. It's like a lot of people will be like, well, tariffs will take over income tax, for example. I don't know if that's going to happen. You know what I mean? Because I don't think we should be a completely tariff dependent economy. Everything is completely different. And the idea where a lot of people are very critical of globalists and they want to be more isolationist, I also don't think that is reality. And in order to deal with that, I think these trade deals are really significant in rebalancing to our benefits, to being America first. And, you know, I can only see good things with that, specifically when it comes to domestically. Like, I don't care about Europe and hurting their feelings because of some new I really don't care. Like, the amount of times I got to see Europeans criticizing, like, we seriously are living rent-free in their brains. And I'm very indifferent to that. I see reshoring of U.S. manufacturing. I see money coming back to pay back the deficit. You know, they're talking about cutting rebate checks for the Americans. Absolutely not. I think that's the stupidest idea whatsoever. Please pay down the deficit, because in the long term, we won't need those rebate checks because we're going to be doing so well. So,
and sell more energy for something like, we could probably pay down the deficit with this AI revolution. We could see a deflationary cycle because everything gets less expensive in addition to massive growth. But then on top of that, we could sell more energy from like all of our public lands and things and pay down the deficit. We could outgrow that. And China has a bigger deficit than we do. So it's like, I don't know. These are
It brings also like this entire panic where, you know, the big, beautiful bill is ranked in polling so low. And yes, you can say there's issues with it. However, I think a lot of the issues that people are most concerned about will be overcome because of these trade deals, because of the way this administration is revamping and handling the economy. And at the end of the day, the hope is that people who did have, because a lot of the people that are on Medicare right now and the alleged cuts that the bill does is because of an expansion from the previous administration, which are able-bodied people that could be working. And if we improve our economy, you won't need this stuff. Like, the Democrats are like, they're cutting all these people off and they're trying to kill them. I was like, no. We're trying to create a situation where you're not going to need it and you can do for yourself. And that's really what, you know, I hate to say like the golden age, because it's just so Trumpian and it's okay. But I do see it. I would say that my biggest criticism so far is it's surprising to me how good this administration can be with PR one minute and how bad it can be the next. Yes. And that in particular, and it applies to everything. It applies to our foreign relations, specifically when we're dealing with Israel and with Russia and Ukraine. But just in general, that poor messaging, like, why aren't we talking about and why aren't we selling the big, beautiful bill and how these trade deals contribute to our economy and how much better we're doing, especially with the midterms coming up and the economy going to be such a big messaging concern, which thankfully, even though Trump he's stagnant, the Democrats are horrible. And for the most part, even though they're frustrated with maybe some of Trump's policies, they are more confident in Republicans and the economy. And that tends to be what people will vote most for. So I don't know how the midterms work out. But my biggest criticism right now is just overall PR flubs when it comes to not just foreign policy, but things domestically. It's been driving me nuts, especially I mean, we're not even going to get into, because I would love to pick your brain because you're Gen Z, and I would love to pick your brain on the whole Epstein debacle.
Oh, God.
Don't have time for that.
No. Another time. If that continues to be a story, another time, but hopefully that's dying.
Yeah, I feel like, fingers crossed, that's dying down. I was like, really, dude, of all the times, like, this is not the time. Like, you have other things that you need to sell right now. And I really think, especially when we come to trade deals and foreign policy, it has a huge effect on our economy domestically, which is what matters to people most. And it, frankly, is what lost the Democrats the election. I mean, immigration also, but being gaslit into inflation's not really that big of a deal to it being. And I think you're seeing something similar where a lot of times Democrats and talking heads will be like, our economy is not doing great. He isn't in a meeting. But like, everybody's kind of like, you know, yeah, prices could go down, but I feel more confident and I feel more secure. And even businesses are feeling more secure. Things aren't feeling as detrimental as they did during Biden. But I would say that's kind of where we sit at. I don't know. We got another 6 months and then we have the midterms and it's only going to get more interesting from there.
So, definitely.
Well, I'm going to go ahead and wrap us up for today. I want to thank Amanda for joining me today. So last minute.
Thank you.
But we love to have you here because Rachel and I only have minimal understanding of what's happening abroad. And that does affect us domestically. So I think to give our listeners a holistic understanding of what this administration is doing, it's really important that we check in periodically and see what he's doing on the world stage. Do you think he's ever going to get that Nobel Peace Prize?
God, I don't know. I don't know. If he ends Russia-Ukraine, I don't see how he couldn't get it. But I kind of tend to sit on the... Well, but I don't know. Every time I doubt him, he gets it. So maybe they will give it to him. I don't know.
I know. It's wild. I'm really curious and kind of afraid what politics is going to look like once he... I mean, he'll still be a kingmaker out there, but he's not... It's not going to be the same. Obviously, he's not going to be in office. So, all right, I'm going to go ahead and wrap us up for today's episode of Rivera and Reeves. Thanks, you guys, so much for hanging out with us. If this is your first time here, welcome. You have found your new favorite podcast. Make sure that you give Amanda a follow. She has a Substack. She's on TikTok. She's on X. If you want to learn a little bit about Thailand and Cambodia, you just did a post on that, didn't you?
Yeah. So thank you. And I also have a true crime podcast, which...
Oh, I forgot about that.
Just started the second season launching. So the second episode should come out today. But
which I was fascinated that you did that because I was like, are you just using public clips? But you went around and talked to people. Like you did a legit investigative true crime podcast. So if you guys are fans of true crime like I am, I'm going to share that link in the show notes. Go check out her podcast. It's a great listen while you are doing your household tasks, which I know most of you are
right now.
All right, that's it. And here is a reminder that the media is trash and we have no tolerance for it. Bye.
Life is a workout and Smoothie King is here to help you power through. Whether you're grinding out bicep curls or muscling the couch across the living room, crushing morning miles or sprinting through back-to-back meetings, Smoothie King has fuel to help you maximize your workouts, own your recovery, and elevate your game. Give your body the energy, protein, and power it needs with a lineup of delicious smoothies made to help you conquer your goals. Only at Smoothie King.